The sound you hear is the sound of space. It was collected in the quiet West Virginia hills near Greenbank at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. One of the projects now underway at Greenbank is nothing less than listening for signals from other intelligent life on other planets. A report from outer space.
NBC Television presents World Wide 60. Tonight, report from outer space.
Good evening, I'm Frank McGee, NBC News. Well, the space age is not yet 3 years old, but things that were fantasy just yesterday are suddenly facts today. This is a report on why the United States is exploring space and what difference it makes. And the report begins here in Washington in just a moment with David Brinkley's impression of life in the age of space.
Period in man's history for its dominant element or discovery, the Stone Age, iron, bronze. But lately, we have been declaring ourselves to be in a new age before we had really lived to learn to live in the old one. We were not yet entirely happy with the air age when we moved into the atomic, and we certainly had not learned what to do with that one when we came into or were dragged kicking and screaming into the age of space. But now that we're in it, what is it and where are we? Nobody really knows, but we do know that in ways that are subtle, obvious, superficial, or profound, it is changing our lives. We know that not since the Greek and Roman empires have the names from their mythology fallen so lightly from so many tongues and headlines, Mercury, Atlas, Nike, Zeus, Juno, Titan. Anyone as old as, say, 40 will remember that when children played airplane, they shouted, "Contact." More recently, "Roger," "Over." But now, everywhere, it's the familiar countdown. Thousands of people and billions of dollars doing jobs that 10 years ago did not exist. Some of this is best seen in Southern California, where Roy Neal is waiting to show us around.
I live in California's San Fernando Valley. At the far end, 20 miles away, they test rocket engines and rattle the windows of my home in the process. It's enough to remind me and my neighbors that the age of space is upon us. We are surrounded by much of its business, which has changed to the degree of placing heavier emphasis on the white-collar workers than on Rosie the Riveter. Drawing board workers far outnumber the production line. The companies, many of them, are the same that grew big in Rosie's time building aircraft. Some have even kept the same names and called themselves airplane companies while building missiles and space vehicles. Others have added astronautics divisions or missiles and space divisions, and around their newer factories, whole new neighborhoods have grown. About 40% of the industry is concentrated in the far west. So, three times a week, there's a chartered passenger plane flying round-trip shuttle Los Angeles to Cape Canaveral. And the second main line of travel finds a preponderance of passengers on the Los Angeles to Washington jets carrying briefcases that identify them with the businesses of space. And for the story of the space age in Washington, here is Peter Hackus.
Here in Washington, you just can't have a project without an agency. You can't have an agency without initials. So it was inevitable, I suppose, when the space age dawned that Washington have a thing called NASA. That's NASA, which stands for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. It was born in October 1958. Already, it's the fifth largest executive agency. As of now, it has more than 16,000 people on its payroll, 12 scientific research centers around the country, and a yearly budget of nearly $1 billion. From all over the country come thousands of letters to NASA. A woman volunteers her husband, lovingly, for a future space flight. Children have offered to go. Some have enclosed letters of consent from their parents. Each day brings blueprints and schemes for weird spaceflight contraptions. And each one, incidentally, is looked into. A woman in New Jersey claims she hears strange things on her hearing aid every time NASA fires a space shot at Cape Canaveral. And a bowling team at the Library of Congress is called the Satellites. And incidentally, it leads the league. Why all the interest? Why are we putting so much money, time, and attention into what's out there? The reasons in just a moment.
To solve problems of time in space, the great Longines Watch Factory produces the world's most advanced timepieces. This Longines Siderograph for flight in space. This Longines Telemeter Tachometer for space measurements. Longines produces this Olympic timer, official watch for the 1960 Olympics at Squaw Valley. This fifth-second chronograph, this 100-second timer. But above all, Longines makes the world's finest wristwatches. Longines proudly offers for your personal use the most precise, dependable, and elegant watches in a complete selection to suit every personality and every need. Longines, the world's most honored watch, winner of gold medals and grand prizes at world's fairs and government observatories. The watch that has won more accolades and distinctions than all the watches in the world today.
The first question to be asked about space research is why? Why is the United States spending nearly $1 billion a year to explore space? Several experts are here to help us give the answers. First, Dr. T. Keith Glennon, head of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration.
Space is the greatest new frontier to be breached by man in over 400 years. Not to explore it, now that the means seem to be at hand, would be unthinkable. Backing away from this opportunity would be a denial of our heritage of seeking constantly to acquire new knowledge to be applied by mankind for beneficial purposes.
Mr. D.D. Wyatt, Assistant Director of Spaceflight Programs, NASA.
It's impossible to foresee all of the practical benefits of space research or of any kind of research. But we know that there will be rewards. There always have been rewards. All exploration of all new frontiers since history began has led to increases in the world's standard of living. This is how we rise from the dust.
Dr. William Howells, professor of anthropology at Harvard.
It would be rather interesting to find out if there actually are living creatures on other planets, and if so, whether they are anything like us.
Dr. Robert Jastrow, one of NASA's top physicists, and one of those planning what to do on the moon.
We have three principal scientific purposes. One, as Dr. Howell suggests, is the search for other life. Another is to uncover the history of a solar system and the universe. And the third is to find out all we can about the sun and how it controls events on Earth, because everything on Earth is dependent on the sun.
Well, devotion to science may be a very good reason for space exploration to the scientist, but some of us wonder how much we'd be doing were it not for Russia. Dr. Glennon?
Among the many areas of competition between our way of life and that of the Soviet Union, space exploration is the most visible, the most exciting, and the one in which the Soviet Union continues to enjoy a propaganda advantage. It's reasonable to believe that a substantial part of the money being voted by the Congress for the nation's program in space exploration is given to us because of our competition in this field with the Soviet Union. What we are doing is determined by our scientists and engineers in fulfillment of our stated mission. But the pace at which we are moving and the amount we are spending on this program is determined by the competition and the urgency with which this nation views this task. I'd like also to knock down one or two misconceptions. We're not exploring space because we hope to colonize the other planets. We're not expecting to find rare minerals there. I also believe it is a mistake to think that space is going to be of great use for military bases. We can do much better with the intercontinental ballistic missiles we already have. On the other hand, meteorological, communications, early warning and reconnaissance satellite systems will be useful to the military, in my opinion.
The space program began to pay off for the scientist with the first satellite ever sent up. This year, we've begun to see the possibility of dollars and cents returns for the rest of us. We asked Mr. Wyatt for a report.
We have no idea of all we're going to learn and what it will all mean. we can be certain that we will learn of things about which now we cannot even dream. As a matter of fact, we've already had some surprises. It's useful to remember that when Columbus set out on his famous trip, he was looking for India. Since January 31st, 1958, we have launched 21 experiments. Eight are in orbit around the Earth, two around the Sun. Five are still talking to us. One of the most significant practical results of our research so far has been the promise of better understanding of our weather. The truth is that we do not really know why the weather occurs as it does. We do not understand the basic mechanism. But now we have Tyros, our weather satellite, sending us pictures of the clouds from above. This is the cloud picture that was received, for instance, in one pass over Western Europe. By the way, this is the size of the camera that took the pictures, somewhat smaller than those we use on this program. We know that radiation from the sun might affect our weather just as it causes occasional radio interference and the northern lights. Our satellites are measuring this solar radiation and radioing the information back to us. When we have continuing news of the weather all over the world and in the upper atmosphere, we should be able to improve the accuracy of our forecasts. If we can improve these forecasts, we will save billions of dollars a year. We can button up for hurricanes and get the smudge pots going in Florida in time to offset a cold snap. And think in the future of what it could mean for countries depending on an agricultural economy. If we could say in advance, this is going to be a good year, or this year there's going to be a drought. Now, we might relieve the hardships and suffering of people throughout the world. Communications and navigation satellites also can have significant advances in our civilization. Our program includes putting a balloon 1,000 miles out in space to bounce radio signals off it from New Jersey to California. The day is not too far off when satellites will be launched to relay telegrams, telephone calls, and live television programs from any part of the world to any other part. These developments in communications are, I think, extremely important. They may lead us to a better understanding between men of all nations and reduce the likelihood of war. The man you're likely to fight with is the man you don't understand. Major scientific discoveries have already been made. 2 years ago, Dr. James Van Allen put Geiger counters in our first Explorer satellites. The counters revealed two enormous radiation belts around the Earth. Bands of electrically charged particles trapped by the Earth's magnetic field like filings around a magnet. The exact nature and energy levels of the particle is now under study. We know that these radiation belts are going to be dangerous, or at least a nuisance, when it comes to putting a man into space at heights of above 600 miles. Another interesting discovery was related to the shape of the Earth. We'd always thought that the Earth was spherical, except for a bulge at the equator. The orbit of the first Vanguard satellite indicates to us that the Earth is, in fact, slightly pear-shaped. It's a little humbling to note that Columbus, too, thought the Earth was pear-shaped. In the next several years, we want to put a telescope into orbit up above the atmosphere where we can observe the whole electromagnetic spectrum coming into us from the stars. Now we see only the part of it that the atmosphere lets through. We may learn more about the nature and origin of the universe from this than from any other single experiment. But again, you can never predict where the payoff will come from any kind of research. All we know is that the rewards have always been greater than the cost.
The most glamorous, terrifying, and controversial aspect of the space program now is Project Mercury, the plan to put a man in orbit around Earth and bring him back alive. Well, Dr. Vannevar Bush, among other distinguished scientists, thinks the project is a stunt and a waste of money that could be spent usefully elsewhere. Well, Dr. Glennon, this seems to be as good a time as any. Why are you spending $345 million on this project to shoot a man around the Earth?
Well, in the first place, this is not a stunt. The best piece of scientific apparatus in the world is man. We've not been able to develop a mechanical substitute for the judgment of a human being. Only man can cope with the unexpected, and the unexpected, of course, is the most interesting. So all of our plans for scientific exploration assume that eventually man will go into space. The trouble is that although all of us think man can be useful out there, none of us knows for sure. If man cannot perform useful work in space, it's quite possible that the direction of our efforts will have to be changed. So it's important to find out about man's capabilities in space, and soon. There's only one way to settle this question. Late next year, we hope to put an astronaut into an orbit 120 miles above the Earth's surface. Let him circle the Earth three times and then bring him back safely. We think this will tell us much of what we want to know. This is the simplest possible way to know and at the earliest possible date.
Project Mercury has NASA's highest priority. Sometime next year, an Atlas booster will be fired at Cape Canaveral with a manned space capsule for its nose cone. When it reaches a height of about 120 miles, the capsule will go into orbit around the Earth. After three orbital trips, a total of about 4.5 hours, small rockets will be fired to slow down the capsule, get it out of orbit, and back into the atmosphere. 20 minutes later, dropping underneath a parachute, the first American will return from space to land in the waters off Cape Canaveral. What you're seeing is man dipping his toe into space. It's the beginning of Project Mercury, which itself is the beginning of an overall program to send man out to the moon and beyond and bring him back safely. This rocket, called Little Joe, is test firing an empty space capsule. At a certain height, an escape rocket is fired, separating the capsule from its launching booster. This rocket will be fired if the astronaut gets into any trouble, to get him away from an exploding booster rocket, for example. This firing was a test of the escape rocket, a test of the parachutes which will lower the capsule into the water when the astronaut returns, also a test of the capsule itself and how well it will survive the shock of hitting the water. The capsule is 9 feet tall and 6 feet wide at the base, shaped something like a television tube. After hitting the water, a smoke bomb is set off and dye marker is spread, which, along with radio signals from the capsule and a flashing light, are to guide a recovery ship to pick it up. One of these seven young Americans will become the first U.S. astronaut. Navy Lieutenant Malcolm Carpenter, Air Force Captain Leroy Cooper, Marine Lieutenant Colonel John Glenn, Air Force Captain Virgil Grissom, Navy Lieutenant Commander Walter Schirra, Navy Lieutenant Commander Alan Shepard, Air Force Captain Donald Slayton. Each of the seven Mercury astronauts has been fitted for his own individual couch on which he'll be lying during his flight. At this point, none of the seven knows which one will be chosen for the first flight. Even the top Mercury officials haven't yet decided. It could be any one of the seven. And before the Mercury program ends, every one of them expects to make at least one flight up and back. One of the many tests each astronaut must take is to sharpen up his reaction time. The astronauts call this an idiot box. It tests the time it takes to translate the brain's reaction into wrist action. A delayed reaction to a signal from the ground or to a capsule emergency indicator could mean life or death to a man in space. Another test, the thermal chamber. It's heated up to 150 degrees by white-hot wire coils to test each man's ability to function, to do good, useful work in case the temperature controls fail inside the capsule. Besides the protection of the space capsule, the astronaut will wear a pressure suit, which will feed him oxygen if the cabin system breaks down. This is a test of orientation ability, practice for the astronaut in keeping himself on a steady course, even though his surroundings outside seem to be tumbling topsy-turvy. It's also aimed at teaching the astronaut to keep a level head when his capsule begins to tumble in space. One of the toughest parts of the training, riding the centrifuge. As it spins faster, the centrifugal force imitates the tremendous weight he'll feel when the capsule is launched, up to 15 times the pull of gravity. Inside the cabin, the astronaut responds to signals. The astronauts get their training at many places. Some of it at St. Louis, at the McDonnell Aircraft Corporation, where the capsules are being made. Take a good look, gentlemen. One of you will be riding inside it next year, perched on top of an Atlas booster, hurtling into space. You'll get a first taste of what it's like this fall when you'll ride your capsule out over the Atlantic in the forward end of a Redstone rocket. Then, perhaps a year and a half from now, the first U.S. astronaut will look down on Earth from his orbiting capsule. From his vantage point, one of the seven men you've just seen will send back a weird, fascinating report, information vital to future flights, toward the day when man widens his horizon to the space beyond. After Project Mercury, get man to the moon. We'll have a report on this next step into space in a moment.
I am happy to announce a new Longines watch to commemorate the 1960 Olympic Winter Games, the greatest in history, exclusively and faultlessly timed by Longines to set a world standard in perfection and precision. This new watch is the Longines Olympia, a champion in its own right, a medal winner for superlative performance. A Longines Olympian can be the last watch you ever need buy. It's a lifetime investment to share every hour of a busy man's work or play. Longines Olympians, priced from $75 to $100, are among the hundreds of handsome and distinguished Longines watches for every taste, for every need. Longines, the world's most honored watch, the watch that has won more accolades and distinctions than all other watches in the world today. Sold exclusively by Longines Whitnor Quality Jewelers.
Man's first stop in space will be the moon. One of those planning what to do there is Dr. Robert Jastrow of NASA.
The moon may have the answers to some of the most important questions in science. How was the solar system created? How did it develop and change? Where did life come from? The particular importance of the moon is that it's the only accessible object that can give us these answers. The reason for this is that the moon has no wind and water to erode its surface, to wear away the record of history, to destroy the cosmic dust that has fallen there for billions of years. The Earth and Mars and Venus are not of much help to us in this connection. Their surfaces are churned up and worn away. The record is gone. But the moon is the only nearby place where this record is preserved, and that is why the moon is so important to the scientist. Until we get to the moon, all we know about it is what we can see from the Earth. We think that there's a layer of loose rock on top of hard rock further down. We think there's probably a foot or so of dust or sand on the very surface, but we don't really know. There's a general impression that the surface of the moon is rough and craggy, but more recently, by measuring the shadows on the surface, we find that on the whole, the moon is a rather gentle region. Landing on it will be like landing on the Sahara Desert. No slope is more steep than about 10 degrees. With a laboratory and a slow-motion camera, you can simulate how the moon's craters might have been made by meteorites millions and billions of years ago. This is one of the largest craters on the moon. The smallest ones we can see are about a mile across. They were formed from meteorites, which came in about once every 10,000 years, and less often for the largest ones. Now, the interesting thing about the moon's surface and its craters is that they are all round and they look just as they did when they were formed. The Earth has probably been hit by as many meteorites as the moon, but here, earthquakes, atmosphere, and oceans twist and erode the craters so that they disappear from the surface after about 10 million years. The moon, however, is too small to hold an atmosphere, and it probably never had much water. Furthermore, it doesn't show many signs of moonquakes. In fact, it doesn't show any signs of disturbance at all. That's why we think the moon's surface bears a very long history. We're going to explore the moon in a sequence of steps. The first is what we call a rough landing of instruments. 2 weeks ago, NASA let contracts for this, a package containing a television camera, instruments to measure radioactivity, and other experiments. We hope to send up these instruments in about 2 years. We may also put instruments in orbit around the moon, and later on we will make soft landings with more fragile instruments. As the ultimate in unmanned exploration, we may land instrument stations that can move around. These will rest during the lunar night and then come to life again every 2 weeks when the sun rises. They will be powered by solar batteries. The most rewarding phase of lunar exploration will come when men reach the moon. Instruments can only measure what we expect, but a man can find what we weren't looking for and what is therefore the most valuable. We hope that the first manned flight to the moon will take place in about 10 years, and the serious manned scientific work a few years after that.
To each of us, understandably and quite properly, our moon seems to be the most important moon. Our planet, the only important planet. Our sun, the only star that matters. And our solar system, just about all there is. But there are billions of other stars, other solar systems, other planets. And so there have been billions of chances for life to develop among them, just as it has here. In a moment, a report on our search for other life, somewhere along the limitless paths of the skies.
Report from Outer Space will continue after this pause for station identification.
Seen in relation to the universe, the Earth is only a speck of dust. And while we who live on it are capable of the most monumental feats of vanity, the greatest of all would be to assume that ours is the only planet on which anything lives, grows, reproduces itself, and dies. There must be billions of other planets, and mathematically it is monstrous to assume this is the only one that has life. In a clean, remote valley at Green Bank, West Virginia, the National Science Foundation runs a radio astronomy observatory. One thing that goes on here is Project Ozma, named for the Queen of the Land of Oz. A vast, saucer-shaped antenna turned upward, collecting noises from space as a sail is put up to catch the wind. Somewhere there may be life and intelligence as great or greater than ours, trying to find out something about us as we are about it, maybe with radio signals. Ozma searches for them, signals from the planets around the two stars nearest to us. The sound you hear is what they hear at Green Bank. Dr. Otto Struve is director of the observatory, and Dr. Frank Drake runs Project Ozma. They have had a talk with NBC's Bob Abernathy.
Well, I remember that when I was a student of astronomy a great many years ago, it wouldn't have been respectable for a science student to even talk about the possibility of life existing outside the Earth. And things are very different at the present time. We're not only talking about life, some form of life on planets, in the vicinity of the Earth, but also about life in the universe.
Yes, I think even 3 years ago, we would have been thought silly to talk about the things we're actually doing today. Since the advent of the Sputnik, we've seen that some things that seem rather far-fetched are distinct possibilities. We must take such things more seriously.
You've been looking for these signals for about a month now, Dr. Drake. What have you found?
Well, we have only done about one quarter of the observing we want to do during this first attempt. So far, we have not completed proving the absence of any signals above a certain magnitude, nor have we proved the existence of any signals.
In other words, you don't know?
At present, we can't say that there are not signals, nor can we say there are.
By the way, how far away are you observing?
The two stars we are observing in this first attempt are each about 11 light years away. This means that any signals we might get originated 11 years ago.
Dr. Drake, if signals were coming our way, what would they say? How would they come?
It's very difficult to imagine what a signal would be that we would receive from another creature. But all we can say is that there would be something systematic about it. It might be dots and dashes or what have you, but it would be systematic, and that's all we can say.
Do you think we can ever learn, assuming that we receive signals, do you think we can ever learn to communicate with those others?
Yes, I'm sure we can. After all, a child learns to communicate, and we have the same advantages that he has.
How would we do it?
Well, there are several ways we can use what might be called the cosmic Rosetta Stone, which consists of the laws of physics, the laws of mathematics, and the arrangement of the universe, which are common to all civilizations. Probably a more efficient way is to use television and teach a language just the way a child is taught to speak, to show him an object and give him a name for it.
Television over 11 light years?
Yes, this is quite feasible.
If you could communicate with other creatures, what would you want to ask them, or what would you want to say to them?
I think it's almost impossible to say now what we might ask such creatures. The first thing we would have to find out is what sort of creatures we were dealing with.
But surely, have the results so far met your expectations?
Yes, I am very much in favor of the observations that have been made and that will be made. I expect that after some period of time has been devoted to the present observations, there will be an interruption. The next step will probably be observations with an even larger type of antenna. And as Dr. Drake has explained, the reach in space now is relatively small. And Dr. Drake is observing only two stars at the present time. Now, if he had a larger antenna, say a 2,000-foot antenna instead of an 85-foot antenna, we could probably reach out into space, well, how far? About 1,000 light years or so?
Something of that order.
Dr. Struby, if we ever do make contact with other creatures, would you expect to find them less advanced or more advanced than we?
I would say more advanced, probably. I did not at any time say that there are such civilizations now in existence. But your question was if contact is made. Well, now chances are that if such a contact were made, their civilization would be more advanced than ours, because our civilization has not yet reached the point at which we are beaming signals to other beings in the universe.
As Dr. Struve said, the question here is one of probabilities. With all the stars we have, the probability of there being other creatures is extremely high. And maybe the proper question to ask is there an intelligent community sufficiently close to us to achieve contact? This is very difficult to say.
And if you had a 2,000-foot telescope, do you think you would find signals from intelligent life?
Well, now, to be absolutely truthful, I would say that I do not expect to live long enough to have such signals recorded.
What about Dr. Drake?
Well, Dr. Drake is a very young man, and he may live long enough to see some.
Some people think that if we ever do make contact with other creatures, we should not reveal ourselves because it would lead to an inevitable fight. What do you think of that, Dr. Drake?
I think it's too late, in that man has been radiating vast amounts of energy off into space for at least 30 years now. And anyone who is very advanced and who wants to become aware of our presence is certainly capable of doing it already. There's no use in remaining still at this time. It's too late now.
Dr. Struve, do you have any special name for the others who might be out there?
Now, this is a new question. No, I have no other name, and among ourselves we call them the Little Green Men.
Well, if there are Little Green Men, what might they look like? One man with some opinions is a professor of anthropology at Harvard, Dr. William Howells. Dr. Howell?
Green or pink, I think they probably look something like us. Of course, they might be so totally different that we can't imagine them at all, but they would have had to appear by evolution, the same as ourselves. And we know that the same natural laws hold everywhere. We have gravity here, they have gravity there. All this talk of communication is futile unless these other people can communicate, unless they are highly evolved, intelligent beings like us. We aren't going to communicate with algae or insects. What does this mean? It means a brain, that is to say, a physical center for high intelligence and a high-speed nervous system. And we can't imagine such a thing evolving without a good use for it. This means input and output. In our case, it means eyes and ears, for senses, and also muscles and the ability to move around. Above all, a pair of hands with plenty of fingers. Those are the things we got by evolution. These other people must have senses to communicate with. We use our ears as receivers, but we also read with our eyes, and even by touch if we're blind. Possibly they don't speak and hear if their atmospheres aren't right for sound. The chances are excellent that they see with eyes. Their world must have light, and eyes have evolved several times over here on Earth. Their minds could easily be an improvement on ours. However, we are on better ground when we ask ourselves what they will look like, because we understand our own bodies better than our brains. Now, animals have to use legs for moving. Legs are found not only in our own animal group, the vertebrates, but also in the insects and their relatives like spiders and crabs as well. These same animals also have heads at the executive end of the body. This is where they see and smell, and perhaps they even feel with antennae. There you have the ground plan for successful animals on the surface of this earth. A head at the front, a body with two sides, and limbs. This gives them what I required. Seeing and moving, input and output, with the brain in between to make them efficient. This may not be the best plan in the whole universe, but it gets the most votes here on Earth. At any rate, it favors the idea that people in space are fundamentally like ourselves. The only improvement I can suggest is that they would be better off than we are if they had four legs to balance on and two arms as well. Land animals on Earth developed from fish with only four limbs, so that when we evolved, we had to balance on our hind legs in order to use our front ones for hands. This may strike us as a noble attitude, but it's not sound engineering. So I will guess that the typical outer spacer will look like the mythical centaur, half man, half horse, with six limbs, four to stand on, and two to use. Well, there's another interesting question, that's sex. Sex isn't necessary to reproduce. Some kinds of life manage without it. But having two parents to combine their different units of heredity greatly increases the variety of the offspring. And this variety is what lets evolution work efficiently by picking and choosing. This is the real reason for sex. And so the chances are they have it elsewhere as well as here. They may even have more than two sexes, but two is enough for the purpose. How big they are may depend on matters of eating and of gravity. Large animals are more intelligent than small ones, but they run into gravity problems. We are just about right on Earth, but people from other worlds might be larger or smaller. They might turn out, in fact, to make nice pets for us, or we might make nice pets for them.
Our report continues with a look at the plans for the spaceships of tomorrow in just a moment.
A thing of beauty is a joy forever. I recall these words when I first saw this truly beautiful new Longines watch. Its name is Fleurette. Fleurette by Longines. a thing of beauty, so fresh, so new in style. See the pear-shaped crystal. It's not glass, but pure synthetic sapphire, next to the diamond in hardness. It will last forever, scratch-proof, unbreakable. Fleurette by Longines, how it glows. Discreet facets, throwback spatters of light. The hand-wrought case is 14 karat gold. Fleurette by Longines, $135. So meticulous is the workmanship of Longines, its creator, it will be a joy forever. Accurate, reliable, enduring. To give your lady a Longines, the world's most honored watch, is to give a thing of beauty. Your Longines Witten or jeweler will be honored to serve you.
One of the facts of the space age is that almost every major American aircraft and engine company has plans for a spaceship it would like someone to buy. Roy Neal reports from Hollywood.
In 1865, in this ship, a crew captained by the famous author Jules Verne was fired from a cannon for a round trip to the moon. As far as we know, they were the first humans to travel in outer space. In 1929, Captain Buck Rogers became the first American when he took off in this ship for the planets. By 1938, things had progressed. The Earth was invaded by the men from Mars, and we heard it on the radio. All science fiction, of course. And there's a lot of it today. Lots of fun. But in this year of 1960, a real rocket plane, the X-15, is pushing at the frontiers of space. And we have real satellites and man-made probes into outer space. We also have big corporations working with their right hand on today's space programs, while with the left they're making their plans and blueprinting the projects they hope to sell in the future. In a highly competitive business, these corporations must plan ahead. Now, these designs have not yet been bought, but everyone is considered practical by the well-paid scientists and engineers who conceive them. Now, let's begin at the level of manned space stations. The Boeing Airplane Company figures this research station can accommodate 12 persons and remain in permanent orbit about 300 miles above the Earth. It's designed to be set up as a single package and is complete with a 60-inch telescope in a trailer. The Lockheed Company figures differently. Their proposal uses prefab units that would be assembled in space. When coupled and working, a 10-man crew could live in this 94-foot wheel in 15 compartments like those of a ship at sea. There's a space ferry to move supplies and men to and from Earth, and an astro tug for repairs. That same company has a second space station on its drawing boards that uses a building block type of construction so that it can be enlarged as required. According to its designers, by the way, this station could be in operation within 10 years if approved. Other ideas range from Rocketdyne's 5-man space station to their 50-man one for the day when we have big engines capable of putting 250,000 pounds in orbit. There's a maneuverable satellite and an inflatable one. If meteors puncture this balloon with men inside, colored gases would spot the leak for patching. Northrop figures that electrical power could be obtained for their 4-man space station from a bank of solar cells. And the Martin Company says we could have this space station within the next 5 years using new engines now being constructed. The big dish is for power from the sun. The little extension is a nuclear power supply. There's a ferry for the trips to and from Earth and a space tug to complete the plan. Another proposal which hopes to capitalize on the big engines now being developed comes from Kraft Ericke of Convair Astronautics. Called Outpost 2, it's intended as a training station to acclimate would-be space crews for living in space. The whole thing rotates slowly end over end to provide artificial gravity. An atomic power supply is separated from the living quarters to keep the radiation away from the men. There are also laboratories working on the problem of food and air supplies, on ways to make space vehicles self-sustaining with a just right balance of plant and animal life, such as our own world maintains. At Boeing, right now, specially bred bacteria reduce matter to liquids, and the microscopic plant algae purifies the air supply as well as being used to make an edible white flour for food. Now, these are algae cookies made from algae, and they say you can't eat them. By darn, you can. After 3 or 4 years, though, on a planetary expedition diet of algae and bacteria, Imagine the reaction when that spaceman gets back to his first big, juicy steak. Well, let's move on to the Moon, Mars, and Venus. A number of industry spokesmen say that perhaps within 10 years, from a manned space station in orbit, a manned space ship will take off, fly to, and land on the Moon. Film from North American, who make the X-15, among other things, shows how they think it will look. Another big company, Douglas, has set up a moon station complete with living quarters and a spaceship, tugs, and a spaceport. Boeing's Martian Explorer could be assembled in space, and it has a self-contained solar-powered transmitter. Their counter-moon manned research station might be handy for such things as the navigation of spaceships. And here's a detailed study from Convair for fast manned reconnaissance flights to Mars and Venus. Nuclear power, real food supply using those algae products only for emergencies, mission profiles, only 541 days for a round trip to Venus and 347 days round trip to Mars. It's an unusual design. Those tanks drop off when they're all used up. Equally unusual is their planned shape for the interplanetary chemo-nuclear electric spacecraft Urania. Aerojet General, who are in the engine business, have this four-stage model proposed for a lunar transport. They've also just completed a feasibility study on a simplified big-engine ship called Cosmos. Notice its size. This scaled automobile may give you some idea of the actual planned size. Rocketdyne spaceship design would draw its power from the sun. Another one uses nuclear power. The wings would radiate excess heat in space and might even be used for landings in an atmosphere. Do you remember the sound barrier for airplanes? Well, at NORAIR, one scientist has visualized a disintegration barrier from dust particles in space which might actually limit our speeds to less than that of light and confine us to our own solar system. Of course, there are many more immediate problems to be resolved. In a laboratory at IBM, radar systems for navigation are being built and tested right now. Another new type navigation device will work from a computer to pinpoint locations on a map. This one's for work near Earth. Others will one day map the planets, all based on the need for electronic backup in navigation, guidance, and communication to make up for human shortcomings. On the outskirts of the space business, for many years, the makers of kits for models you assemble at home have had access to the files of the big companies. This is the Helios, scientist Kraft Ehrke's design in a model from Revell. Their files are marked top secret and kept locked because they contain actual secret information. Another model, the XSL, Experimental Space Laboratory 01, was designed by a research scientist now with Lockheed. They have no models, though, for the kind of spaceships you and I may ride in, perhaps as soon as 1980, if we believe some top executives in the airplane and space business. But there are some well-considered calculations. Douglas Aircraft builds passenger planes and has gone to the trouble of this brochure, complete with costs and sizes and shapes for a space transport system. They actually figure it's possible to run tourist specials to Mars to see a site like this every couple of years when that planet is closest to Earth, and the trip will be shorter as a result. A round trip will cost as little as $2,000, and figured in are such important tourist necessities as stewardesses and luxury foods, all based on a practical, high-thrust, nuclear-powered rocket engine, which does point up the big problem of how do you get more than one flight out of a rocket. Our present systems are uneconomical since the rocket is used only once and destroys itself in the process. It's like being able to take your new car out for only one ride. A top scientist at Aerojet, Robert Truax, proposes recoverable engines parachuted back to Earth. At Lockheed, they like a winged engine that could be flown back to Earth. Bell Aircraft suggests an airplane to get out of heavy atmosphere before the big rockets are fired. They claim this design would make practical trips from Los Angeles to Paris in just over an hour. A byproduct of the space age. Fiction? Perhaps. But the big industry of today is spending money on these plans for tomorrow. And this week, here in Los Angeles, members of the American Rocket Society, 5,000 scientists and engineers held a meeting at which exploration of the moon was one of the major topics for discussion. Despite the many problems, to most of the industry, our move into space, as you can see, is only a question of time and money.
With all our talk of space travel, even with all the progress we've made, don't let the astronautical optimist fool you. Vacations on Mars are hardly just around the corner, and they're not merely a few million dollars away. Cost is one of the problems, of course. Much of the money will go into licking the problem of power, lots of power. Even small payloads like this need a big boost. This is Vanguard 1. It weighs 3.5 pounds, but it took 37,000 pounds of lift power, thrust as it's called, to put it into orbit. And as the payloads got bigger, we had to have bigger launching boosters. More power will be needed, and much more, to boost man, or say a ton of instruments, into space. And for such a job, we'll need Saturn. Saturn is under construction right now at Huntsville, Alabama. It will fly a ton of instruments to the moon, or to Mars, or to Venus, or it can fly two men around the moon and back again. But to get really far out, or to land man on the moon and get him back again, we'll have to have this monster. It's called Nova. When it's ready, Nova will ship two or three men to the surface of the moon and have enough power left to return them. Nova, incidentally, will stand as high as a 26-story building. And that's just the beginning. The farther out you go, the more weight you send, the bigger the boosters will have to be. It's as simple and as expensive as that. Besides the cost, there's the medical problem. Can man endure the rigors of space travel, the problems of protecting man from possibly fatal radiation, the problem of bringing back something from a space orbit, which incidentally has never been done, and the problem of space rendezvous, how to reach a point out there by aiming somewhere else? We may not be able, incidentally, to learn the laws of physics in space until we actually get out there. Above all, we must have ultra-reliable equipment. Tested, retested, tested again thousands of times. Everything has to work so perfectly on a flight into space, of course, no repairs are possible along the side of the road. We need to build large payloads to do many things over a very long time with complete reliability. Can we do it? Can we lick the problems? Well, we wouldn't have come this far if we didn't think we could, but there's still a long, long way to go.
Finally, what difference does all this make? How is the space age changing our minds? Dr. Glennon?
I think our whole outlook is changing. I think space exploration is already making a profound effect on what we think of ourselves and on what seems to be important to us. I know I cannot look at the moon anymore without wondering what is really going on up there and what really happened when Lunik II hit it. Later this year, we expect to have a useful spacecraft in orbit around the moon. I think the most intriguing part of space exploration is the possibility of finding other intelligent life. What happens if there are Martians out on Mars who are well advanced? Most of us do not believe there is any rational life there, but there's enough evidence that something grows there so that we should not write off the possibility of there being intelligent life on Mars. For me, I find the one world idea taking quite a different, more important place in my thinking. If indeed there is rational life someplace else in the universe. The quarrels we have around Earth may seem suddenly quite petty. I also think space exploration is making a significant difference in what we believe about why we are here. Most of us have always thought our Earth had a special place in the universe and that we human beings had an even more special place. What happens to these ideas if we pick up signals from another world, from creatures more advanced than we are? I think we probably have to face up to the fact that we're not quite as unique as we have always thought we were. I think space research is going to give not just the scientist, but everyone, a new sense of awe of the vastness of the universe and of how insignificant the place of each of us is within it. At the same time, and here is the paradox, everything we're doing is a testament to the genius of man. Our scientists have been able to predict with reasonable accuracy the things they're now proving about space. And our engineers are designing and building engines and payloads of almost unbelievable complexity. When properly trained, the human mind is a pretty amazing thing, no matter where it is in the universe. When the Soviet Union launched Sputnik and hit the moon and took pictures of the back of the moon, the world was impressed. Russian propagandists were able to give many people in the world the idea that because of the spectacular nature of her successes in space, Russia leads all other nations in all of science and technology. Now, we need to change that belief, and I think we're doing it. Everything we're learning, we're giving freely to all other countries. I think we're finding out more about space than the Soviet Union is. And I think the rest of the world is beginning to realize this. I think in the long run, we, not the Soviet Union, will be recognized as the nation which has made the truly significant contribution to the welfare of all mankind.
Well, man has always had more questions than answers, and he's bridged the gap with guesses. And this has meant that with each new answer, some old guess has had to give way. This is a painful process because it stretches the mind. We did not easily accept the fact established several hundred years ago that the sun and not our Earth was the center of the known universe. But this doesn't disturb us now, nor will the discoveries that may soon be made disturb us for long, because we have and we will continue to adapt ourselves to survive.
Worldwide 60, brought to you by Longines, the world's most honored watch. The watch that has won more accolades and distinctions than all other watches in the world today. And by the Whitnor watch, distinguished companion to the world-honored Longines, premier products of the Longines Whitnor Watch Company. For almost 100 years, leader in quality watches.
The NBC News series, Journey to Understanding, with a complete report on the meeting at the summit. This is Frank McGee, NBC News. Good evening.